Years after the failed 1974 movie musical of The Little Prince, producer Joseph Tandet tried again. But this time he mounted a full Broadway production, which brought with it a whole new set of problems. Now, it began rehearsals in late 1981 and starred TV and film actor Michael York as the pilot, as well as a 10-year-old newcomer, Anthony Rapp, as the Little Prince. Well, I am so thrilled to have Anthony join me today to talk about that troubled production, which actually never even opened on Broadway. We also discuss Rent, of course, and Star Trek Discovery, and a few other moments in his career where he wasn't sure what to do next or when he would see that light at the end of the tunnel.
It really felt like all doors had closed. And I don't even remember auditioning for him. I don't remember having meetings. I probably did here and there, but it just felt like no one was called. It was like total desert crickets.
Welcome back to another episode of Why I'll Never Make It, a Top 25 Theater Podcast. I am your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, an actor and singer for almost 30 years. The past couple of episodes, I have focused on The Little Prince, with actors sharing the struggles and hardships during those productions, as well as the ups and downs they faced afterwards. To find those episodes and more, check out the website at whyillnevermakeit.com. There you can also support WinMe financially and contribute to its ongoing production. Again, that's whyillnevermakeit.com, or just look for the link in the show notes. Well, welcome, Anthony. It is so nice to meet you and so nice to have you on the podcast. So thank you very much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you. I never get to talk about Little Prince, but
I know. Yeah. I wanted a chance to talk about things that you don't normally get to talk about. Obviously, Rent and other shows have been a big mainstay of your career as far as, you know, what people know you for. But us actors, we have so many things in our resume that may not get much attention. So it's always good to bring those to light.
Sure.
Well, the first story, as you said, that I want to talk about, what was to be your first Broadway show in 1982 was called The Little Prince and the Aviator, and it was based upon, of course, the famous children's book. However, the director and choreographer were replaced during rehearsal process, the Broadway previews were delayed, and eventually the show closed before it ever actually opened on Broadway. Now, it just sounds like a roller coaster ride for you and the cast.
Yeah, I actually was originally cast as the Fennec, the fox. And the understudy to The Little Prince, because they were concerned that I was very young. I mean, I just turned 10 at the end of October of 1981, right before we started rehearsals. So they were understandably, you know, concerned about a 10-year-old being able to carry a show. But during the rehearsal process, I don't remember, you know, so long ago, I was very young. I don't remember the exact amount of time that passed, but not too long into it, they actually changed things where they'd made the actor who had originally been cast as the Little Prince my understudy. They made an adult actor, the Fennec, and I became the Little Prince. And I can, you know, all these years later as an adult, I can only imagine how devastating that must have been to actor who was cast. He was, I think, 4 years older than I was, maybe three, something like that. It must have been very, very hard for him. But I mean, it was incredibly exciting for me. To get that. I was plenty happy to be playing the Fennec. It was a really fun role also. So that was the nice upswing on the ride. I mean, I had a very good time throughout. For whatever reason, I always, as a kid, from the first moment I ever did any kind of rehearsal and show at my summer camp theater where I made my debut as an actor, I just always loved being in that process. So whatever the process was like, however it was going, I was happy to be there. You know, I can look back again as an adult and see, oh yeah, there are things that were chaotic and weird. But for me, it was just like, I was just rolling with it. I was just happy to be there, having a really good time, learning all these songs. I got to fly in it, like flying by Foy, you know, the guys that did Peter Pan.
Oh yeah.
That was really fun. I mean, all of those things, I have really happy memories of it. And I can also recognize that it was probably a really rough show from a, you know, audience perspective.
Well, yeah, especially for a Broadway show, because as you mentioned, you started rehearsals, you say, in October, and then
well,
it was
something like in this November, somewhere in there.
Then because then it was set to open at the end of December. of that same year, but previews didn't start till January. So especially in today's terms, that's a quick turnaround for a Broadway show to begin and then to open.
Yeah. And I couldn't even tell you, we certainly didn't do weeks of tech rehearsals the way they do now. I think sometimes some shows do like 4 to 6 weeks of tech rehearsal.
I know, it's kind of crazy. Yeah.
I think maybe we did a week, maybe. I mean, and we had some technical things go. We had like flying, we had things on tracks, which then was still pretty, there weren't that many shows that were doing automated tracks coming on or off stage. We had the planet that the Little Prince was on a cherry picker, like you would see at a construction site. So that was part of our set. We had people in, like the guy playing the snake was in a interesting snake costume where his arms were becoming like the cobra head above his head. So we had to like, he had this very skin tight outfit and he had like move like a snake and keep his arms up. And we had a lot of things going on. There was dancing, there was a big plane because it was the aviator, you know, all that stuff. And we had a pretty short period process, as you said, and there was staffing changes during it too, which I don't even, like that's a part, like as a little kid, I don't even think that I registered.
So for you, what was that audition process like since you were originally cast in a different role?
I don't honestly remember the material I had to do for the auditions, but I believe I was first seen in Chicago, where I grew up outside Chicago. So they did like a nationwide search kind of thing. And then I had at least one callback. I think it was only one session in New York. And that was the first time I ever went to New York. My mom and I, it was her first time being in New York. We flew to New York and I remember getting out of the cab from the airport and looking up at the Chrysler Building and thinking it was the Empire State Building, which I'm sure that 99% people.
Everyone does, yes.
I also immediately fell in love with it. I'd been to Chicago. That was the other major city that I'd been to, and I like Chicago, but something about it, I couldn't tell you exactly what, but I just felt like I was home. You know, so the audition process was, as far as I remember, enjoyable. Like, I feel like I was well treated. There was nothing about it that was scary or weird or dangerous, you know, feeling or anything like that. I've said this before in other interviews that I've given, and that I don't know if it's ever really come across. So this was the early 80s. This is before the internet. This is before reality TV. This is before, like, where I grew up, we weren't thinking about becoming famous. It wasn't about like trying to get your profile and your become an influencer. It was just simply like just putting one foot in front of the other and, oh, okay, now we're running New York and I'm going to be in a Broadway show. There was no like grand design. And I was fortunate enough to have a mother who was just incredibly supportive and eager for all of us kids to have whatever things in our life that we wanted. I was the only one who was pursuing acting, but you know, my brother was an athlete and she was very supportive of him being, you know, in basketball and track and field and baseball. So I say that to say that it wasn't like we had our sights set on like coming to New York and becoming a professional actor and becoming famous. It was just like, oh, this is what we're doing. We were very naive in every way that it could be. Yeah, not knowing what would come of it, not certainly thinking, oh yeah, Broadway show is going to close before it opens. I mean, that was for sure.
Well, yeah.
You know.
Who could have predicted that? Yeah.
And my mom was the breadwinner of the family. She was a single mother nurse, and she had three kids. And at some point, it wasn't right away, but we went out alone at first, and then my brother and sister joined us. But like right after that, the show closed, and then we were like, what do we do now? So it was kind of a chaotic family too, as much as anything else.
Oh yeah, I bet, because now you, your mother, your family are planning on this show to at least last a few months, you know, who knows how long.
Sure.
But yeah, you don't expect it to close right away. So I can only imagine, because were there any signs that you can remember during rehearsal that it was troubled? I mean,
well, I was oblivious to it if it was. I mean, I was just having fun. Like I said, now I was in it, like I see, oh yeah, the director was fired. Yeah, that's trouble. There was a lot of material got changed a lot, but I recognize that's just the case of almost any show that's in development. So that's not necessarily a sign of trouble. You know, Michael York was lovely to me as a 10-year-old child. He could not have been more lovely. And Ellen Green, like all, David Purdom, who played Fennec. I mean, all of the adults were just so wonderful to me. I'm sure that they were going through a really stressful moment because they could see the writing on the wall, I'm sure, in a way that a little kid me couldn't.
And I'm sure that they tried to maybe shield you from some of that as well.
Yeah, that's certainly possible and probable. You know, I remember going into Michael's dressing room at intermission and running lines with him. And I recently moved and I found a note that he'd written me that was just lovely, really supportive. And I'm certain that it was a crazy thing for him. I believe it was his musical theater debut, or at least Broadway musical theater debut. I mean, I know he was in the film of Cabaret, but he didn't really sing in it. So he wasn't really a singer. So it was a big risk for him too. And his name was above the title and all that stuff. So I'm sure he had a lot riding on it. I'm sure it was a huge sense of setback and disappointment. If it was, I don't have any memory of that being filtered down onto me in any way, shape.
Yeah, because this production, the producer of this Broadway version, Joseph Tandet, he also produced the Lerner and Lowe musical movie. Did you know of that movie, or had you seen that in any way?
I don't have a memory of seeing it then. I've seen it since, but I don't think I'd seen it then. I was very familiar with The Little Prince because I'd done a production of a play adaptation of it when I was like 8. And it was a really special experience because it was a theater in which deaf and hearing actors worked together. It was a community theater, but
wow.
The director who was hearing, she worked with and somebody to help her adapt it. And so that there were some actors who were deaf and signed their role. And then there was a speaking actor, sort of like what Deaf West has done in their productions. And I, as Little Prince, spoke my lines and signed. And I'd read the book. And so, I mean, it was very much a part of my spirit and my soul. It was something that had meaning, resonance for me. But other than that, I don't remember any other knowledge. And I know it's an interesting thing because its adaptations have been attempted multiple times over the years. And it seems like no one has really gotten it right. But, you know, it's like some pieces of work, their best version really is on page, maybe, you know. It's just everything has its place and setting. And some adaptations can kind of heighten things and illuminate things and make them special in their own right. And some things that just, something gets lost in translation.
I think I saw the movie whenever I was in my teens. And so I was, you know, had been doing a little bit of musical theater up to that point. So I at least knew who Lerner and Lowe were and this and that. So I at least was interested in it just from a musical standpoint. But then critically at the time, it did not do very well. But I love the movie and it's kind of gotten a fan base ever since. But even since the book was written, for whatever reason, The Little Prince has been a difficult property to translate onto the stage, especially. And looking back on it now, from your memories of having done those two productions, do you see a reason why it's just so difficult?
I think because it's very much an allegorical parable kind of story. And I think that there's something about the delicacy of those types of tales that maybe just lend themselves a little bit better to that inner voice poetry experience you have of reading words and imagining it in your head. And whenever anything's on stage or on screen, it becomes literal in a way that maybe just it's harder to maintain that ineffable, mystical, mysterious experience of what the imagination can do on its own. I don't know. That's just a theory.
No, but it does make sense. To read a book and have a certain idea of what it looks like, what it feels like, what this particular relationship is like, but then to see it, it'll either meet with your expectation or it won't.
Exactly.
And it just seems like people's imagination may be a lot wilder and a lot more inventive than whatever productions they've seen.
Yeah. And, you know, then every once in a while, if you have somebody in the realm of the Julie Taymors who can come up with these wonderfully invented ways to make these fantastical images on stage that you can feel the magic of it. You know, in its best moments of Lion King, like they really, you really feel like you're seeing something truly otherworldly. But it's still at the same time, there's moments in Lion King where you're still, I'm still watching an actor in a puppet thing. It gets there's times where it just gets a little like,
Now, as I was editing and putting this episode together, I actually discovered something very interesting. Joseph Tandet, the producer, actually did hire Julie Taymor to do the set. Tandet had seen an off-Broadway show she had running at the time at the Public Theater, a musical called Haggadah, based upon an old Hebrew folktale. Taymor created the set, costume, puppet, and mask designs for that show, which was her very first off-Broadway credit. Now, just like Anthony, The Little Prince and the Aviator was set to be her Broadway debut as well. But when the original director left during pre-production, the replacement director wanted nothing to do with Taymor. Either you fire Julie or I quit, he said. Well, Tandet needed a director more than he needed a set designer, so unfortunately Julie Taymor was let go. Whenever the show did close, whenever you found out you weren't going to open, how did you find out?
I mean, my memory is like I don't know if it was in a meeting, an announcement. I remember being very sad. like as a 10-year-old, like that was a big sad moment and totally unexpected. And again, I wasn't sad because I wasn't going to be like opening a Broadway show. I was sad because the experience was like, we didn't even get to have the pleasure of having an opening night.
Right. No party, no, all those things that come with that opening night. Yeah. So how long did you and your family stay in New York? Did you go back to Chicago after?
No. So we had just gotten a place in Staten Island, and it was, this might sound like I'm making it up, but it's true. Like the heat was really messed up. It didn't have much heat. We didn't have a refrigerator. We put our food on the windowsill. It was winter.
Oh my goodness.
And we were like trying to figure out what we're going to do next. It was crazy. There was a point at which I almost like sang on the Staten Ferry to make a little money. Because we had no money coming in, the four of us. But pretty quickly, like I think within a couple of weeks, I auditioned for and got the tour King and I that Yul Brynner was doing. And so that happened pretty quickly. And then I went just right there and joined the tour down in Florida. My mom went home with Adam and Anne, my brother and sister, and got them settled and then came on tour with me. So it was a whirlwind bananas thing. Again, as an adult, I come up back and go, wow. As a kid, I was just like, oh, this is what we're doing. You know, it's just one thing in front of the other. No sort of like long-term plan or awareness or thinking of anything in terms of a career or anything. Just having these experiences and these opportunities.
Well, you certainly survived that setback and, you know, not only have continued to do theater, but you made movies as well. And three of your movies, we're talking Adventures in Babysitting, which was your very first film.
Mm-hmm.
Then there's School Ties and Dazed and Confused. In these movies, the producers did not want to cast you, yet the directors did. Now, did you find out about these differences of opinion after the fact or during the audition process?
It's hard for me to remember exactly when I found out, honestly. So with Adventures in Babysitting, I did a screen test and it went very well. And I think Chris Columbus told me this when we were on set, probably, but I just don't remember for sure. But they asked me to come back and do a second screen test. And for the second screen test, they dyed my hair red, which was the color it wound up being in the film. And when they dyed it red, they dyed it permanent dye red. They didn't do like a rinse. So it felt like it was probably going to happen that I was going to get the role. But so what I found out was that the I don't know if it was the producers exactly or the studio, somebody at Disney, I think, not necessarily the producers themselves, was concerned that I would be, as a blonde person, that I would remind people or be too reminiscent of Anthony Michael Hall, who at the time, you know, this is after Breakfast Club and Pretty in Pink. And I don't know, was he in Pretty in Pink? But all the, was that, you know, was sort of in
all those 80s movies. Yeah.
So one of the executives at Disney was like, oh, we can't cast a blonde kid in this role. So then they were like, well, let's just dye his hair. But then they dyed it red, they dyed a red permanent dye, which because Chris was like very calmly wanted me. Anyway, so that was the first time that, the director had to go to bat for me, which I appreciate. Second time, School Ties. So there was sort of like Little Prince in the sense that one of the original director, I had actually auditioned for a film for him years before that I didn't get, but I had really good auditions for School Ties and looked like maybe I was going to get it. And then I didn't get it. As they were getting ready to go into production, the original director got hired to become the head of Paramount Studios. So he no longer was directing it. So when Robert Mandel came on board, he actually cast me in the role. So it's a little different, but it's a role that I almost didn't get that I want to get it because of the change of circumstances. And then in Days of Confused, it was similar to Avengers Babysitting in the sense that Rick Linklater, who did tell me this pretty soon afterward, was he had to go to bat for me because the producers thought that Tony, my character in Days of Confused, was sort of a stand-in for Rick. And Rick has brown hair. And so they were like, how could you cast a black guy?
What is it with your hair? With the...
I mean, it's just funny to me because you can always dye hair or... Anyway, so Rick won that battle. We had for Daisy Confused audition, he did a really interesting process. He had like a whole day where he brought in, I don't know, 20 or so actors and he kind of mixed and matched us with all these different combinations. And I think that was the idea of Rick and also the casting director. But like Rick, again, in telling me afterwards, he was like, yeah, you were my guy all along, but I just had to kind of go to bat and prove through this day, like among other things that you could do. Because they were concerned about you not having breath. So, you know, I mean,
it's so interesting that for two of those, your hair was the issue.
Yeah.
You know, the other was maybe just a difference of director, and then then things changed. But so do you know what led to the producers or the studio finally giving way to the directors?
I guess, I mean, through my screen test for Avengers Big Sayer, goes, oh yeah, he can have red hair. Okay. No, Anthony McCall. I guess that solved that. And then I guess
so it was just a change of color.
That's, yeah. And then I guess Days of Confused, I guess, you know, the day went really well. And so the producers were then convinced, oh, okay, he doesn't have to be brown haired. I don't know. My casting wasn't the only battle he had to fight on that movie. Like the producers were pushing against a lot of things that he was doing because Rick comes at things from a very unconventional point of view, especially I think it's a little more conventional now than it was when it was starting out, but he wants the work to be very organic and very like in the moment. And there's a lot of improvisation that goes into the process. And in some filmmaking worlds, that's like, you got to plan everything. You got to have it all like a battle plan. And he's unconventional in what he wants the texture of it to be sometimes. And the kinds of actors that he likes are weirdos, you know.
Well, and Dazed and Confused is a different kind of movie.
Yeah.
It really stuck out in the 90s from other movies that were being made at that time. And because for me, one of my favorites of his is Before Sunrise.
Yeah.
Again, a very, like, just two people walking the streets of Europe. Like, that's a movie? Okay.
Yes.
But he makes it work. He's definitely a different kind of director when it comes to that. And I think it's great that he was able to push for you, especially in, you know, in that movie. Because I remember a theater production that I did. It was almost the exact opposite situation where I had the entire creative team, producers, they wanted me, but it was the director who didn't. He just had someone completely else in mind for it, even though I had nailed the callback. I knew that I had done well. You know, you feel that energy in the room.
Yes, yes.
It was interesting. Once I was told that, it made me appreciate having gotten the role even more so. It's like, oh, so someone had to fight for me. Did you kind of feel that same once you found out?
Yeah. I mean, especially being a director, like there's something, but I've always felt such, I've been pretty fortunate that like 99.9% of the directors I've worked with have been like really good people to work with and for. So I've always felt very supported by them and very, like, it's been a really collaborative experience for the most part. So I think knowing that is probably part of what has led me to really be willing to trust and work with directors, because I know that they have to do this kind of stuff sometimes where they have to really advocate, fight for you. And so, yeah, it meant a lot. It meant a great deal to know that I had their confidence in them.
When it comes to directors on film or television versus theater directors, do you have a different working relationship with them?
Well, on television, in a television series, which is, you know, being on Star Trek Discovery is the first time I've ever had a regular television series, it's a very different kind of dynamic. Our lead, our wonderful actor, or wonderful human being who's the lead in our show, Sinequa Martin Green, she used the terminology kind of that the show was our house and the directors who come on board are essentially guests because they just come in for that episode, most of them. That we do have sometimes where they've occurred now over the course of seasons and then they're part of the family and then it's their house too. And it's not said in a way that's like adversarial, but just, you know, that they're not the boss in quite the same way as they would be in a play, or it's you're just a little more uneven playing field in terms of we know more about the world that we're inhabiting than they probably do. And including like sort of the tone and the history of our characters. And so they kind of many times do rely on us to help fill in some gaps, or, you know, we're both trying to fulfill each other's vision, but we just have a little more say, I guess you could say, in how that vision comes across than we might in a film. But then like people like Jonathan Frakes, who he's directed, I think, 5 or 6 episodes now. That's a lot of time we spent with him, and he's very much a part of our family.
Well, and he's very much a part of the Star Trek universe, course, for sure.
And it helps that he's also a great director to work with. Like, he's so much fun, and he really loves actors, and he wants us to be able to collaborate fully. All that stuff is very meaningful. You know, the only time it can be weird is if a director comes into a TV show that's like this pre-established kind of environment, and they come in with like a way of being that's very at cross purposes with the sort of the way the kind of machine is working. That could be very disruptive. But thankfully, we haven't really had too much.
So when it comes to the TV series that you're a part of, or the films you've done, versus the theater work. Is there one you're more drawn to, the stage or the screen?
No, I'm very much more drawn to stage as a performer, for sure.
I figured.
You know, I've done a little bit of directing on camera. I think as a director, there's a lot of excitement for the extra level of collaboration that can happen as a film or television director. That's a weird way of saying, because there's tons of collaboration that happens as a theater director too, but I don't know. There's something about being on the set as a film director just feels a little more tactile than being, I've directed some plays and some live shows too, which is very enjoyable, but there's something, it's a little more, I don't know, passive. That passive is a wrong word. It's just, I feel like as a director in film or television, you're a little more in with everybody.
Well, I mean, yeah, there are those rehearsals where the director can kind of be there on stage and maybe, you know, kind of more of a hands-on director. But a lot of times there is that table or they're in the house. And so there's a distance. Whereas when I've been on set, the director's like right there. Okay, I want you to, you know, turn on this moment and then deliver the, you know, it's like they really kind of get into it and they kind of stare at you and they say, try it. I had this one director say the line to me, no, try that. Okay, that, oh, you know, okay, and so not a line reading, but more just like,
like
really in my face going, yeah, do it just like that. And then he pulls back. So there's a different approach because you know that the eyebrow, the lip movement, the timbre of your voice registers and rings so much more on screen.
And the camera, you know, working with as a director, talking to a cameraman, like the camera is another character. So
absolutely.
And, you know, so like, yeah, when you're directing stage, of course, the light is a character, the set is a character, but it's just a little, you can get that much more precise and specific in a way that you're talking. Like what the camera is doing is part of that. It's part of the scene also, part of the mode. And that's just fun and exciting to get in there with the technician who's also an artist, is very special.
Do you see yourself wanting to transition to directing or balance that with acting a little more as you go along?
Yeah, well, I don't ever see myself like transitioning out of acting and into only directing, but I would like very much to do both. Yeah,
I bet. Yeah,
I went to film school only for one semester. It was very expensive, and I was paying for it myself. But it's something that I've been very interested in since I was in my early teen years. Watching films by great directors is one of my favorite things to do. I wouldn't want to copy, but to try to absorb what makes those films special, and then find a way to bring that to my work is something that's sort of how I am with actors. When I see a great performance, I don't want to copy it. I don't want to emulate it. I want to be inspired by it. And what is it about that work that spoke to me and have that be embodied?
I think that's a lot of times what we as actors or directors or whatever we're watching, it's like, I see how resonant that voice is, that perspective is, how honest it is. What can I do to bring to my performance or directing that can be just as honest? And so it's still us. It's still a part of who we are, but yet we're taking that, as you say, inspiration from others.
Exactly. Yeah.
Now, with regards to that, was this a semester that you lasted at NYU and then you left?
Mm-hmm.
What was the trigger that said, nope, I'm out of here. I can't do this.
It was money. Seriously. It was money. And the fact that, you know, I think the undergrad program at NYU film school, and this is a long time ago, this 1989, is not quite the same level of training as the grad program. And I think that's true of a lot of arts university programs, that the grad program gets so many more resources. It gets so much more attention. It's a much more kind of curated experience. And an undergrad program is a lot more like throw it all against the wall and see what sticks. It felt more like a trade school than an art school experience to me. So I was a little disappointed. And, you know, at the time, and I think this may have been proved, but at the time we were watching films, you know, classic films as part of one of the film classes I took was Language of Cinema. You know, so we're watching classic films for the ages. We were watching it in an auditorium in a lecture hall. And so we were watching like old prints of movies that the films themselves might have been shot on CinemaScope. And we were watching essentially 16 millimeter prints with bad sound at one of the top film schools in the country, paying a lot of money to do that. So all those factors made me a little like, I don't know if this is worth it. Plus I didn't, you know, was running out of money. I was an actor who I'd saved up some to go to school, but I was like, I wasn't working. So I put my school on hold essentially. And then right away, soon after, I got cast in Securities of Separation, which then became a big hit that I was in for a couple of years. So then I just never went back.
Well, I mean, it certainly seemed to work out for you.
I think so.
But at the same time, at the time, did you think maybe not do as much theater, but film would be the next thing?
No, not necessarily. It was just something that I was very passionate about. And having at that point done a couple of films, you know, working with Chris Columbus on Avengers Babysitting, I mean, I was so spoiled. My first film experience was with a supremely kind and really fun and very collaborative, enthusiastic, passionate filmmaker, Chris Columbus. And that was his first film. So I was like soaking it all up, and he was eager to share with me. So I felt like I had a kind of, it wasn't like directly my mentor, but I had a kind of mentoring experience right away. So that was concurrent with me seeing films by great filmmakers like David Lynch and Jonathan Demme, the Coen brothers, that were like kind of blowing my mind about what movies could be. That all of that was happening at the same time. And that's what made me go like, I want to do that.
Even with all his appearances on television and in movies, Anthony is still known best for his work on the stage. And in this week's bonus episode, he talks about his first Broadway show after Rent, which we'll get to in just a moment. That production was the 1999 revival of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown, which he performed with two other former guests of this podcast, Ilana Levine and Andrew Lippa. Anthony shares the joys of the rehearsal process for Charlie Brown and the out-of-town tryouts all the way through the disappointment of a bad review in the New York Times that led to its short-lived Broadway run. Now, bonus episodes like these are only available to supporters of Why I'll Never Make It. So if you'd like to help this podcast as well, then please consider either a donation or an ongoing subscription by going to whyillnevermakeit.com or just click on the link in the show notes.
Well, it was decades later that you got to work with Christopher Columbus again in doing the movie for Rent, which has certainly been, I assume you would just say, Rent has been a blessing to your life and has given you things that you wouldn't have otherwise.
Yes, unequivocally, from the first moment I did it until now, continues. Yes.
Now, from that moment, even before opening, you know, when you're just in the rehearsal, the collaborative process of creating it, did that show feel different from other previous theater work? Was there energy or spark to the show or role?
100%. From the first moment of the first day of rehearsal, Michael Greif spoke very eloquently about some of the themes of the show. Because, you know, when you're starting rehearsal, that doesn't always happen. Sometimes you just dive into learning the music. But he spoke very eloquently about that the show was about facing grief and crisis and loss, and also trying to live your life fully, that both of these things could be true at the same time. Like that alone was like, that sounds really full of wisdom and strength and possibility. And then the first thing we did in rehearsal was learn Season of Love. And, you know, there had never been a song that I'd heard that was quite like it, certainly in theater. And I don't know that there's really been a song like it since. So right away I was like, oh, and I had listened to some of the music. I'd listened to Rent for my callback, and that was a cool, fun rock song that said, oh, this is cool for music theater. But that didn't begin to tell you what was the power of the show, which so encapsulated Season of Love. So yes, from the first moment of the first day of rehearsal, I was like, this is something really special. And then it just got more so and more so.
Yeah, it's interesting what you said, Michael Greif told the cast about that balancing of grief and then still going on with your life. And it really is amazing how Rent itself matched that with the loss of Jonathan Larson and you know, dealing with that grief. But then also you personally were dealing with your own mother was battling cancer at the time. And so that you had your own battles, she trying to manage that. So you'd mentioned whenever you answered the final five questions that one of your favorite pieces of advice was the only way out is through.
Yes.
So how did you keep going through that first year or so of Rent with Jonathan and your mother losing their fights to these deadly diseases?
I mean, I was very fortunate in the sense that Rent itself encapsulates that idea. So, you know, I think it would have been a very different story if I was in, I don't know, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels or something. Like, the fact that I was in Rent that was in and of itself telling the story of what it's like to live your life fully in the face of all this, not denying that it's happening, not forgetting about it, not pretending it's not happening. It is happening. La Vie Boheme is all about that. Like, to people living with not dying from disease and acknowledging that they are also living with disease and they might be gone. So it's not saying forget about them. It's saying, here, hold them up, embrace them, celebrate them for however long they're here. And then the rest of the show, you know, there's a funeral in the show that we were fortunate as a cast, as a personally, as a friend of Jonathan, that I had that avenue that he'd kind of written for us to help mourn him. So it felt like a gift in so many ways. At the same time, fortunately, we traded all of you to have him still be there. But similarly with my mom, I mean, yeah, that I had a place to kind of put all that stuff that I was going through. You know, and as much as anything else, the rent, also the schedule we were on was 5 show weekends, which is really intense, especially for a show like that. Sometimes Saturday night was the hardest one because like I got 2 more and I'm exhausted and like my voice is tired. How am I going to do it? So like, by Sunday night, like, okay, whew, I can just like relax.
Right. You see the light at the end of the tunnel. It's like Monday's coming.
Yeah.
So with Rent, it's certainly vocally taxing. It's certainly emotionally taxing. But is there one that's like, okay, well, I can at least just rely on, I know my voice is good, so I'm just going to barrel through this? Or is it more the emotional, like, okay, I'm just going to let the emotion carry me, even if my voice isn't with me?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I take really good care of myself physically and vocally. So I would, you know, I never really got like to a point where I was like worried, like, would the vocal come out? But it was just more like I would get, like at the end of La Vie Boheme on a night when I was physically tired, I would almost, you know, that time sometimes when you're singing, like I would be singing the end of La Vie Boheme dancing. And it was almost like I got tunnel vision, like my head, like the blood in my head was just pounding. Like that was the experience. Just having to like run that extra little burst of energy when your body's like, I just need to sit down, but you care. So it was, that was the thing I felt the most. When I went back in the show years later with Adam, I actually had learned even more about nutrition and hydration and stretching and rolling out your IT band and all that stuff. So actually, as an adult, I felt like I was still being really intense in the show, I promise you. But I just felt like I didn't get quite as wiped out because I was able to even take better care of myself than I was as a youngster. Plus, I also didn't have that extra weight of going to my mom's illness and all the extracurricular stuff we were doing in the original show too, all the press and all the recordings and stuff, which was great to do, but it was also exhausting.
Do you feel like that you brought a bit more, certainly you were 10 years older whenever you came back to Rent that second time, you have a bit more experience, life experience and professional experience. Do you feel like you were able to attack the role differently than you did previously?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I felt like I could just trust it more. I didn't have to like prove anything. Not that I felt like I had to prove anything as a youngster, but it just felt like a little simpler, I guess. It's more essential. Things kind of like got down to like the real core of it, maybe a little more. And also like I was visiting an earlier part of myself so I could like, I wasn't in it at my, like when I left the Nederlander as a 25-year-old, I was so much living life Mark. And as an older person, I could look back and see that life that I'd lived. So I could sort of almost let it go a little more. So it wasn't as exhausting. There were times when it was a little too much, like I could never escape it. And so, you know, towards the end, I would take a night off here or there just to sort of give myself a mental health break. But mostly I really wanted to be because I had a chance to kind of channel it in something. And it was something that also that my mom was very, very proud of. And it meant a great deal to her that I was doing. So she didn't want me to leave the show to go be with her. She was very clear about that. You know, so it's like, but balancing it was hard. I'm not saying it wasn't hard, but I was shored up by the fact that I was a part of something that was telling the story that it was telling in a way that was also helping much personally.
It sounds like she, as you'd mentioned before, was very, very supportive of your career, of doing what you were passionate about.
Yes.
And so I imagine that is something that you got from her as far as like living your own life and really pursuing your passions and having that type of drive and persistence.
Yeah. I mean, the sense that I always made of her approach was that she came from in her upbringing, she didn't necessarily feel that kind of support. She had to fight pretty hard to live the life that she wanted to live. And I think she kind of made a vow to herself that she wasn't going to do anything like that to us. So she made sure that we knew that we had her full support. And then she also, I think it helped too, that she was a lover of the arts, and that she felt a lot of pleasure and pride in what I was doing, and that I was good at it. You know, it was, it brought her joy. And I think she didn't have a lot of joy in her. I think we as kids were the biggest source of her joy. You know, she had a really tough childhood. She was a single mom under a lot of stress. As a nurse, she had a lot of pain that she experienced from the people that she took care of. She was very passionate about it. She was a wonderful nurse, but it was like, it was hard, you know? So this was a place where she could feel some light, that light could shine. And so she was, yeah, very much in favor of it. And I was incredibly lucky and grateful that she was able to come to see Rent, because it was the last thing that she saw me do. And it would have been very strange. I mean, I would have been able to find a way, as I know, but it would have been really, really extra hard if she hadn't, because it was such a culmination and the kind of crowning moment of everything that we had built together through years, you know. And she'd seen me like struggle and, you know, not get work. And she was always a huge champion of mine and huge cheerleader and supporter. And so for it to turn out as well as it turned out, was, I know, very, very comforting too.
It sounds like that your successes were her successes as well.
Absolutely.
Your parents had actually divorced when you were a toddler. So as you said, your mother was really your world as being a single parent, raising you and your siblings. I myself grew up with a single mother as well. How do you think that that shaped you growing up with a single mother?
I mean, I think that it probably contributed to my willingness or desire or ability to kind of be so fully absorbed into artistic work, because I was home alone a lot. She was working. So I read a lot. I would, you know, I didn't watch a lot of TV, but I would get very involved in like stories. And then when I did start doing plays, I don't know, just had never had any difficulty kind of jumping fully into this sort of imagination exercise. And so I think that's part of it in some ways, because I had a lot, I was like left to my imagination a lot as a kid. I mean, I'm just grabbing it. Theories right now, but like it makes sense to me.
Certainly sounds right. Yeah.
And like I said, because she was such a supporter of the arts, that it felt very natural and easy. Then like, I know many young actors who've told me that they had to kind of battle a little bit to get the support of their family, because their family was worried about being in the arts and it's not a stable life and all that stuff. That was never a conversation I had. So I feel just lucky also that I didn't have to like transcend that hurdle.
Now, you had released a memoir about your mother and your time with Rent called Without You. And was that a difficult piece to write? Because you wrote it several years after all of that. But was it a little easier to write with that distance?
It was not. It was the hardest thing I've ever done creatively. And I've written a story that got published this past year, which I'm very proud of. That was the first thing I've really written since. I find writing to be kind of lonely. Like the longer I went with writing my book, which sometimes was periods of not writing, the more the pressure of it started to feel like enormous and overwhelming. And then I would know, okay, I have to write this scene now of the moment when I went in and spent time with my mother's body after she died. And I know how I want to approach it. And I know what I want to do, but I just couldn't touch it. It was just too hard. So it was just really, really, really hard to do. But I'm also proud of it. And I honestly didn't expect it to get well received. I thought, you know, who's going to care in a way? But the reception that it got was far exceeded anything that I had hoped for. So I was very grateful for the continued over these years now. It came out like 16 years ago, that it continues to touch people. And, you know, part of the reason I wrote it was there was not a lot of literature out there at the time. Anyway, I don't know about anymore, that was directly about a young person losing a parent. There was other literature that was about losing a parent, like when you're an adult, you know. And even though I was 24 or 25 and technically an adult, it's still like a young adult as opposed to like somebody in their 40s or 50s.
Yeah. And shortly after the release of that book, you created a stage version, a one-man show of the book. It featured your own songs. You conceived the show yourself. Was that a bit of catharsis as well, to present this thoughts and grief on stage that was so personal to you?
It was, but I want to be very clear. Like, I didn't ever think that's what I was going to do with it. And I was actually, there was a young producer that I met who planted a seed in my mind. I was like, I don't know. How do I do it? And a director friend of mine named Steve Mailer, who I worked with in Boston on Henry V, we had a great experience working together. We'd been looking for other projects. And then I got in touch with him and was like, do you think you might want to help me try to adapt this? Because I don't know where to begin. And he's like, yes. And he did me the great service of kind of taking the 300-page book and chopping it into like 100 pages of text that he felt could be the spine of a show. If he hadn't done that, I wouldn't know where to begin. And then we just started like a kind of a workshop process of just sort of like, I have this song that I wrote years ago about visiting my mom. Is there a way that we could try to fold it in to the text? And so we did that and we just tried it. And then we were like, here's what we'll do. We'll do a reading and invite people that we really trust who aren't just going to like, yes, us to tell us if there's something here. Cause I could not have very much objectivity.
You can't separate yourself from a show like that.
Yeah. So we did a night of that at Ars Nova. We were lucky enough to have a connection there that gave us a night to do that. And Brian Bjorke, who had become a friend through working with him on early versions of Next Normal, and then we worked together later. Then he came, Michael Greif came, my brother Adam came, another wonderful sort of advisor that I'd known for many years came, and other friends, and they all unequivocally said, yes, keep going. And that was just like the boost that just said, okay, yes, let's keep going. So we wrote some new songs. We did a whole bunch of stuff. And then we've done several different iterations of it. I didn't know what doing it was going to be like in terms of, I thought it might be a little too much for my system to take. I thought it might be a little too hard, but honestly, it did become kind of cathartic in a way. And I felt like I was going to spend time with my mom in a way that was really, really special. And I would still love to do a proper run of it at some point again in New York. It's a little hard to plan these things in COVID times, plus being in a TV show. It's a little hard.
Yep.
The TV show problem is a good problem to have, but hopefully, you know, that's something that we keep our eyes on. People have said really incredible things to me after seeing the show. I had a young man in Toronto a number of years ago and who just lost his mother, like 2 days before. And I was like, when he told me that, I was like, and you're here, are you sure? And he's like, no, please, yes, yes, yes. So there's many stories like that of people who've shared that kind of thing with me. So I'm very proud of him. I believe in it. It's been a very, very special thing to have the possibility of doing again. And who knows, maybe.
I think that's one of the beautiful things about theater. I mean, even though this started as a book, but I think bring it to the stage, like that young man said, it was something that he needed at that particular moment. And I think theater, its live element, provides such a visceral response and connection with an audience that you can't find in other mediums. And I know for myself, that's one thing that I love most about theater. And no matter what the show is, it can be a heavy, more serious show like Rent, or it can be something light like Music Man. Anything that can connect with an audience and make them laugh or cry is special.
I agree. Yeah. And there was something about doing the show that, you know, this idea of the only way out is through. That's something that I say in show. It's words that come out of my mouth on the show. And in a way, by doing the show itself is living proof that I have lived through this moment. And here I am to tell you helps prove that the only way out is through. I don't know if that makes any sense, but you know, whatever that's worth.
Because one of the professional experiences or things that you went through in between that first run of Rent and your second is there was a gap of time in there where you couldn't find work. You had kind of been going strong, strong, strong through the 90s and then 2000, and you hit a dry spell. What was that like?
It really felt like all doors had closed. And I don't even remember auditioning very much. I don't remember having meetings. I probably did here and there, but it just felt like no one was calling. It was like total desert crickets. And in the meantime, I was also working / not working on my book. So that was hanging. So it was a really scary, rough time emotionally. I was financially okay because I'd been able to save some money from that fertile period. But it was also starting to get like, if I never work again, what am I going to do for money kind of thing?
Was that really something that you thought that, you know, based upon all the success and what you'd accomplished that you might not work again?
I mean, in a certain sense, it wasn't like, I don't know if it was that articulated, like you were never going to work again, but they're like, it just did feel like, Maybe it's done. Maybe nobody's really interested. I don't know. And I got close to a couple things. I did get close to a couple things in that time too that didn't out. I was like, okay. But then I was in LA. I was staying with a good dear friend of mine in his guest house, trying to write my book. Like I was really just trying to do that, which was very much a struggle, and auditioning a bit, but like not much was happening. And I had auditioned quite a while before that for A Beautiful Mind, like maybe at least a month or two. And I hadn't heard anything. So I was like, okay, check another one off that wasn't going to pass. And I woke up in the morning and I had a call from my agent and they're like, oh, they want you to do mine. So it was like, that was the end of the fallow period. It couldn't have been a better ending. I mean, it turned out to be an incredible experience, you know, but if you had asked me before, was that going to come through? I would have said, no way. I auditioned for it so long. I would, like never heard anything. It's not going to happen.
Did you ever have a sense of, well, they don't want Anthony Rapp anymore. Maybe I need to do something else. Maybe I need to branch off into something else. Or maybe I need to audition. Was there ever a thought that you needed to do something differently?
Not necessarily. Yeah. I mean, I was also doing a bit of teaching here and there and, you know, doing some music stuff. So I was like, I have other things in my back pocket that I'm going to try to make. I was writing my book under contract. So I did have that going on. But I never got to a point where I was like, I'm going to change careers altogether or give it up. But I did wonder if it was, if I was toast, if I was cooked, you know?
Right.
So I fully know now, especially after all those years of being at this, there are people who win Academy Awards and then some of them still work 2 years. I mean, that happens. It's just a weird thing. I remember in the early 90s when I was doing Six Degrees of Separation, an actor friend of mine was doing a two-character play at Ensemble Studio Theater, this tiny little theater in Midtown. And I went to see it, and in it was this actress named Edie Falco. And she was incredible in this play. And I also seen her in like Hal Hartley film. So I was a little aware of her, but I was like, this actress, she's amazing. We both lived downtown. We shared a cab afterwards, and on the cab ride downtown, she was like, yeah, I can't get arrested. I don't know. I might have to give it up. It was a full like 8 years later that she got Sideman and Sopranos. And she was always one of our best actresses, from my estimation, from seeing her in this little two-character play. That's all it's going to do. So it's not like she magically overnight became the amazing actor that got, you know, that won all these awards. She always was that, but it just, for whatever reason, it just happens differently for different people at different times.
Yeah, I think that's one of the beautiful but also frustrating things about this business is that it can be. There are those people that just kind of like, oh, what, acting could be fun. Let me audition for something. And they get it. And it's just like, boom, it was this huge role, huge movie or show, whatever it is. And then there's Edie Falco, there's you, there's me, where we have these moments of, okay, I'm doing everything I've done before to get work and now it's not working. We start to question ourselves. We start to wonder. We start to think, well, this is as good as it's ever going to get.
Yep. And, you know, it's a long life and, you know, things come and go, you know, it's pretty wild.
Now, for you being in your position, you certainly have things on your resume that a lot of people don't have. Does that give you some assurance? Are you at a point now where you don't worry about that?
Yeah, maybe I'm naive, but I feel pretty good. I'm going to get to work and stuff. For sure. But yeah, I mean, I also know that I have enough colleagues and friends that we could say, let's come up with something together if it really came to it. If we could, you know, like I did with my friend Steve, the director, you know. So that is something I feel fortunate about too. If I have to generate my own work in that sense too, I'm happy to do that as well. So I don't mean to say like, oh, I got it sewn up. Yeah, no problem. But I do feel like I've earned enough of a reputation that I could be counted on to, you know, quality work and I'm good to work with. And yeah, that I could say, you know, down the road, if a couple years from now, I'm like really twiddling my thumbs, I could, you know, call up a couple of my friends and say, is there anything? Can we do a little something just to like make something happen? You know, we'll see. You know, maybe.
I definitely think it's good to have those people in your life, but also those ideas, those sparks that will just keep you going whenever months turn into maybe more months or maybe a year or two.
Yeah.
So What do you say to those who are kind of in that in-between? We're not really well-known, but we're certainly not beginning. But what do you say to those who want to continue but are finding that struggle, finding that, when's the next job coming? Why am I not getting this? What do you say?
I mean, I would say that you can only control what you can control. And what you can control is trying to fill your life with as much stuff that does bring you fulfillment as possible. Because the vagaries of this business are almost never going to line up the way you want to. So yeah, sometimes you'll hit the jackpot of a great, amazing experience. And sometimes you miss out on those things. But what you can control is how you find things that fill your soul. So I would urge you and others to try to find for those periods of time. And that's probably easier said than done sometimes, but no one can take that away.
Yeah, it's ultimately up to us. It's very true. Well, Anthony, this has been such a joy to talk to you, to get to know you better. And I really appreciate you opening up and sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you so much for asking me. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for joining Anthony and myself today. But remember, the conversation continues with that Charlie Brown bonus episode, as well as the final five questions on the WinMe blog. You can find a link to the blog in the show notes or by going to whyillnevermakeit.com. Well, I'm your host, Patrick Oliver Jones, in charge of writing, editing, and producing this podcast. Background music is by Blue Dot Sessions and John Bartman. Why I'll Never Make It is a part of the Helium Radio Network and a member of the Broadway Makers Alliance. Join me next time as we talk more about Why I'll Never Make It.
You'd mentioned whenever you answered the final five questions that one of your favorite pieces of advice was the only way out is through.
Yes.
But considering the heaviness and seriousness, considering the heaviness and serious, I can't say the word serious. There we go. Considering the heaviness and seriousness of a show like Rent, was it a nice change of pace to do something light and fun like Charlie Brown?